Hi, my name is Connor.
And I'm Jason.
And you are listening to the Amaze and Perplex podcast.
We are continuing with the chronological progress of Jesus' life. And last time we looked at the temptation of Christ. And at the end of that experience, it says that angels came and attended to him. So my assumption is they physically, spiritually, mentally, emotionally, they strengthened him. And then he went off and there's a sense that, okay, now his ministry begins. It's a little bit uncertain what the progress is in the Synoptic Gospels. The book of John, which does not feature the temptation, though, frames that, which I believe is some of his, we believe, some of his first interactions. And if you look in John chapter 1, we will not cover all this, but it kind of sets it up. Initially, John is asked about being the Messiah, and he denies it. And then following that, beginning in verse 29, he testifies about Jesus to the people around him. He sees Jesus, but doesn't interact with him. So before we jump into this reading, Connor, what jumps out at you in terms of setting this up? We want to give dignity to every verse. And so thinking about the, specifically of Jesus, the emotional, the physical, the mental mindset of coming where he's coming from, and then proceeding into this interaction, what jumps out at you?
Yeah, so I love to think about what, and again, this is going to sound like, maybe this is going to sound like a Christian leadership conference sort of thing, but I love to think about like how Jesus would view leadership in this scenario. Mm. There's this great faith, like step of faith that John is giving, and it'd be so easy for John to be territorial, to be, you know, like, you know, to want to be the main one on top of, like, you know, the movement of God in this moment. But to John's credit, he's not, and he puts Jesus in the place he's supposed to be. But still, there's some awkwardness when you think about, like, man, I'm a person that is so compelled by the message that John is giving, and I'm baptized, I'm repenting, I'm turning away from the things that were sinful, and I'm, you know, taking on this new mantle of trying to live the call of God in the way that John has presented it to me, and I become a disciple of John. And then all of a sudden, John's like, hey, I'm out of here. Let me clear out of here for you. There's this new guy. He's fantastic. One that I loved the idea of thinking about the specific, that like follower of John's mentality, but then also just thinking about Jesus and, you know, what that would be like to be, you know, taking up these, like, not, I'm not saying take up this mantle, but just simply the process of like, what was that like for Jesus as he came into like this position of authority, leadership, however you want to phrase it, over some of these men.
I think that's exactly right. I think to assume that Jesus felt no insecurity simply because he's walking with the Spirit, I think that's overreaching. John was established by this point. John had followers. People were going out to see him. Jesus was the new person. And we know about Jesus, and we see through all those lenses, here's where this goes, and he does things that John the Baptist, as far as we know, couldn't dream of doing. But he's just getting started, and that always is scary. There's always a learning curve. And again, this challenge for us to see the humanity of Jesus, I think, is especially pushed in this way because in not knowing what's happened before, like, has he dealt with a lot of people to this point, or has he been kind of reclusive to this point, you know? Mm-hmm. And then, so now he comes out of the wilderness. John the Baptist, who is the, you know, man of the hour, points to him. A couple of his people come to him, you know. Yeah, how will Jesus do this leadership? How will he interact with people? What are the starting points? Some of the most nerve-wracking things when you're doing something for the first time is, how do you get started, and what's appealing to people, and what do you say, what do you not say? So I just think we have to assume that was on his mind.
Sure. And you think about, so is this the first time that he's ever called rabbi? And he's called rabbi in this passage. And you think about what all that term would have meant for the people. You know, that was a great term of respect, and it meant a specific thing. So not even just like in John, we'll see here that the disciples say we found the Messiah, but even simply the smaller step of being labeled a rabbi, which would have had great honor and great respect. And is that the first time that ever happened? And so all these firsts are happening for Jesus simultaneously while still trying to establish a relationship, his ministry, like all these firsts for the first time. And yeah, I think it just gives me so much connection with Jesus to think about all these separate elements. And you go like, how do you how do you take a step forward in that without just falling? And I've been in a situation where like I followed somebody into ministry and I felt like all that when I took a step forward, I just face planted each time. And my goal is just keep getting up and, you know, face planting faithfully forward. But Jesus doesn't do that. And yet I still think Jesus must have had some of those feelings to one degree or the other. And he didn't know if he'd be met by complete rejection at first. Like, I'm sure he had faith that God was going to carry him through and his mission was going to be successful. But the individual things that happen along the way, the specific individuals, like, who's to say that Jesus didn't have a conviction that one of these people would be one of the people and then they were to reject him or whatever. There's so much here that I love picturing Jesus in this moment.
Yeah, I do too. And again, I think it's really important to remind ourselves, Jesus hadn't read the book of John yet. You know, he didn't know what was going to happen. He trusted God in the same way you're being asked to trust God today. It's like with all this unknown, and you just have to say, hey, God's ready for today, so I'm ready for today, and I'm just going to go with it. Like even in this interaction that we're going to see, I don't think this is a big plan. He's simply walking by John. A couple of days in a row, and that's what leads into it. So
that's great. So let's get into it. So John chapter 1, starting in verse 35. The next day, John was there again with two of his disciples. When he saw Jesus passing by, he said, "Look, the Lamb of God." When the two disciples heard him say this, they followed Jesus. Turning around, Jesus saw them following and asked, "What do you want?" They said, "Rabbi," which means teacher, "where are you staying?" "Come," he replied, "and you will see."
So they went and saw where he was staying, and they spent that day with him. It was about 4 in the afternoon. Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, was one of the two who heard what John had said and had followed Jesus. The first thing Andrew did was to find his brother Simon and tell him, "We have found the Messiah, that is, the Christ." And he brought him to Jesus. Jesus looked at him and said, "You are Simon, son of John. You will be called Cephas," which when translated is Peter. Okay, so with all that in your mind, what jumps out at you? What amazes you about this interaction?
I think what amazes me is just how easy it would be for all of this to be missed. You know, like how many little things had to happen for Peter to end up where Peter ended up in the time that he ended up. Like for John to not say, if John the Baptist had not said this, if Jesus hadn't phrased it, or like there's just, I just think about them like walking down the road and there isn't this, you know, altar call moment where, you know, it happens. There's just all these simple things where they could have made a simple decision otherwise, like come and see, and okay, well, maybe I'll come and see later, or, you know, hey man, I just met you, so I'm going to not come and see, but, you know, I'll kind of keep track of your work. There's so many things that could have happened here where each person has to be living on, each person has to be living on faith to one degree or the other. And you see what it can look like when they don't all know the full picture of what this is going to be. Like Peter doesn't know exactly where this leads, even to the end of this chapter. And yet there's just simple faith in this that God is weaving together into this really cool story. And it gives me a lot of, it gives me a lot of hope for the small day-to-day interactions that we all get to partake in and the power that they can have. But also too, it gives me a sense of responsibility for thinking about, the weight of this moment is so massive in hindsight, and yet in the middle of it, it doesn't seem like it was probably all that weighty, at least is what we would assign to it.
You fully articulated what I was thinking is amazing about this is just, I was even thinking, what if they're talking about? So we don't know the time frame, really. They went and saw where he was staying, which that's interesting. So he's staying somewhere and they see it. And then why mention it? So that's kind of funny. They spent that day with him. It was about 4 in the afternoon. So they've had, I don't know, we'd assume it was the morning when they got there and it's the afternoon. What are they doing? It's like, so what do you like?
What convinced them?
Are they sharing, what's your favorite music? Like, is he immediately saying, sit down, I am from the Father? And, you know, it just doesn't seem like it's structured. It seems casual. I mean, it really is everything you said, is that this is as profound an interaction as maybe any he has in the whole New Testament, and it is almost nothing. Mm-hmm. I often think this when I'm talking to people. It's just the realization that there are nearly 8 billion people walking the earth right now, and I'm talking to this person. And I don't think it means everything, you know, but I think it means something. And I think it's really important to look at life that way, this idea that I don't have the authority to assess this as insignificant.
That's good.
You know, I just need to be. Now, I also don't have the authority to say this is going to be the most groundbreaking thing. I have met thousands of people, not an overstatement. And so many of those interactions, I wondered, is this going to be significant later? And it wasn't. And then others, I'm like, how, like you and I, like, how are we even connected the way we are, you know? And it's just the series of a lot of little things that God did, and we chose to participate to whatever degree, and now we have this much stronger, both relational and somewhat professional, I guess you'd say, relationship. But it is that dynamic that, you know, some of my strongest mentoring came from people that were very much encouraging me to embrace the wonder of God, and just like, don't think you know. You know what I mean? Don't be obsessed with knowing or not knowing, but just don't think you know. Just experience it and let God lead you. To me, this is bullseye for that experience.
Yeah, it's so compelling to me because it is fully God in the muck and the mire of life. Even here, Jesus is shaping is altering the expectation for what they would have had of the Messiah. The Messiah bends and warps history and culture around him. And in this story, Messiah takes a stroll right through their lives in a normal day-to-day interaction. And for me, that is just so compelling to remind myself, not to be like, oh, like to try to manufacture these incredibly weighty moments or these incredibly spirit-filled moments, but just to even give dignity to my life, to go the ordinary day-to-day commute, the ordinary moment at work or whatever, any of those moments when I'm acting in faith, God can use in spectacular ways. And that's a basic thing, but I think it's important to remind ourselves that, like, we don't have a savior that wants to work above the fray. We have a savior that works in the fray. And so what does that look like for us? That means that our faithfulness has to come in day-to-day, normal, boring moments.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's so important to recognize that when you think of, tell me the great things that God has done in all of history, and you think of these big events, those occupied in most cases an hour, you know, of maybe a 100-year period that nothing else happened. You know, and I'm not saying that makes them insignificant. I'm simply saying the majority of the people that we would say, your Hebrews 11 people, the vast majority of their life was getting up, getting ready for the day, doing the day, going to bed, getting up, you know, I mean, just like us. And I think when we have experiences, like when I went to Guyana a couple weeks ago, when we have those kind of experiences, those are really built up because you're focusing. But it's not a different earth I'm on. It's not different than humans that I'm working with. It's the same thing. I'm just taking time. And as a professional minister, I get to do that much more, you know, than most people. But it's still the same kind of thing. It's just this interaction that Jesus is happening. I was with somebody that was a 20-something yesterday, and
I hate those 20-somethings so much.
And a young 20-something, but I was with him, and we're talking. We have a great conversation, and I said, because it's just true, I said, you're thinking about what you're going to do next month, and God is working with your great grandchildren right now, and that's a weird thought, but that's accumulation. That's this big accumulation of decisions of faith. You know, to trust in God, and then that affects his kids, his grandkids, and eventually his great-grandkids if we're given that much time. And I think that's reasonable for us to think. And that's the key, is it's almost like we have to make a case for, do you believe that the amazing could be happening right now in the middle of the mundane?
So I think we maybe talked about this on a previous episode. I had an opportunity to preach on this at my church maybe a month or two ago. I think about, so I love, and I've said this so many times before, so I will try to go as quickly as possible. I love the story of Abraham and Isaac so much because it's this basic story of God teaching his people, hey, in my kingdom, there's no human sacrifice. That's not what we're doing as part of our kingdom. And then you fast forward throughout the Old Testament to even where we are now and what God is trying to communicate to us. And like, we take for granted the fact that, like, hey, we're not supposed to sacrifice other human beings to, you know, to our deity. And just the patience with which God slowly brought us to assume that that would be the case when that wasn't the case. And I think it demonstrates the patience that God has, but two, just the simple, I think God calls us to extraordinary love, but the extraordinary love that we demonstrate isn't always going to be what we would assume extraordinary love looks like. A lot of times, extraordinary love isn't the grandiose sacrifice, giving up of your life. Sometimes that's the case, and for those people, man, that's fantastic and great. But a lot of times, the daily dying to self, the massive showing of love that we are called to, manifests itself in ways that seem really small and sometimes insignificant, but ultimately blossom into these incredible, incredible earth-shattering kingdom movements.
Thank you.
So all that being said, a lot of really cool things that this is showing us about God and Jesus and his relation to us and how he does work. What perplexes you about this passage?
What's perplexing to me is, I wish you had a manuscript of the whole thing where he was like, well, bathrooms are over there. And you know what I mean? Like, what are they talking about? Because of, they bring Peter, and you got the setup, and they are, we have found the Messiah there in verse, 41. The first thing Andrew is due to find his brother and tell him, we have found the Messiah. That is blasphemy, or on the edge of blasphemy. That is not a small declaration,
Yeah.
And then Peter gets there, and Jesus looks at him and says, so it's kind of that first interaction, I'm renaming you now. It's so abrupt. So it's this... I don't know what's the word, dichotomy, but that idea of, on one hand, that's so mundane and so just casual, we're just spending the day together. And then on the other hand, it's like, I've decided based on this, he's the Messiah. Now, there's not been, as far as we know, any miracle. John the Baptist had a testimony, and we assume Andrew had heard it, but there's that. And then the relational dynamic of, did Jesus give Andrew a name? did that feel accusatory towards Peter, or did it honor Peter? And then what's the fallout to John and Andrew, who had been with him that day? And, there's no sense he gave them a name ever, Mm-hmm. So it's just very, it's the messiness. It's the muddiness. It's the, I would like a clear thing. When you meet a man and you have, or a person, and you have a sense, man, God really wants this, and then do this every time, Yeah. It just is so, man, it just requires me to be dependent on God. And it just seems it'd be so much easier if I just know when A happens, you do this. And when B happens, you do this. And just keep, rinse and repeat. I mean, this should not be that hard. But God is so devoted, even with his own son and the first apostles, to be able to say, no, I need you dependent on me every single moment. And as a function of that, it'll always look different.
So what you're making me think about is what we literally just talked about right before we moved on to Perplexed, was talking about how God, moves things and changes things slowly. The flip side of that is somehow in the normalcy of whatever this situation was, these men were compelled to move. Like to teleport basically from where they were to like some new crazy belief, new crazy way of living, or at least following some new person that was going to mean crazy new things. I think the compelling nature of a God that enters into the muck and mire and is just living normal day-to-day life, acting faithfully, is so compelling to me. It's also compelling to me and incredibly challenging to think about the reality that in Jesus's normal day-to-day living, not, like you said, no evidence of miracles, no evidence of visions or things that these men are seeing, that in Jesus's normal day-to-day living, it produces this miraculous turn in these men. Not these men were like bad or needed to be rescued from death's door, but then that they would be okay with this, that they would be okay with this, like you said, almost blasphemous, I'm not gonna say it, that they would be okay with possibly being accused of blasphemy, or they'd be okay. Like there's so much to move these men as quickly as Jesus moves them is a miracle. And I, for me, it's challenging to sit both with both those aspects. It was something so simple. This interaction is so simple and so normal and just so whatever. And yet it also leads to this monumental change for these men.
Oh man, that brings up so much for me. It throws me back to Elijah in the cave. And when we were talking about that a few months ago, that idea of him being in the gentle whisper, would Elijah have heard that gentle whisper had he just been doing his job, like whatever it was he should have been doing other than running from Jezebel? And the idea of finding it in the common, we're going to see this in the next story for next episode as well, but that idea of making that kind of life-changing declaration, and it's interesting because they were already with a renegade in being with John the Baptist. We don't know how long they were with him, but they are identified as his disciples. And when John declares, I had noticed this in just this last perusing of it, is when John says, look, there's the Lamb of God, not all the disciples go. They're the only two that go, which then raises another thing. What was Jesus thinking? Because we know from the temptations, Jesus wants all men to bow down to him.
Yeah, it was.
And only have two come. It's like,
I'm not going to sidetrack you too much because I want you to keep going, but also, what was John's responsibility in that moment? Like, what was John talking to his disciples after? Like, what do you, like, go talk to, like,
but he said he's the Lamb of God.
You know? And so, but yeah, I would love to talk about that at some point, but keep going how you were going.
Yeah, and it's just the idea of all of this is complicated, and yet there's nothing that doesn't happen in our common world here. You know, and that to me is a big deal because then it reframes, what am I looking for? What has to happen in my world to convince me yet again he's the Messiah? You know, or that maybe if you want to frame it this way, is God at work in my life? Well, what do I need to see to convince me of that? Is it enough that God says he is? Or do I need to see miracles? Do I have the, I don't know if it's faith, but the attitude of Andrew that I'm quietly watching enough to notice, hey, this is of God. How many things am I missing in my normal life because I expected to have some kind of pop and some kind of flash, and then I recognize not much is happening here. There's no prophecy. There's no, I mean, I don't know what he's saying, but it is that kind of thing. His first miracle doesn't happen until the next chapter, you know? Yeah. And so he's not doing party tricks, you know, to say, hey, do you believe me now? Do you believe me now? I don't know. I find that really interesting. What about you? What is it that perplexes you?
Yeah, you touched on it a little bit. I just love the thought of I would love to talk to Andrew about this. To be like, I was the first. I was one of the main guys. You know, I was, you know, I struggled a lot in my youth, and you know, early 20s, but I think I had moved on from this attitude of wanting to be the first one to discover, you know, bands or whatever, wanting to be the first one to be like, you know, I knew them. I had heard of old Taylor Swift before everyone else. I hadn't, but that's just an example. And I think about even, obviously those things are silly in comparison to this, but just that feeling of being like, of as the story goes on, like, it's not like Andrew gets completely cast to the side, but you go like, man, I was there. Like, I if it wasn't for me, you wouldn't be a part of, like, there's so much here that I wish there was more of a more backstory, more like a, you know, I wish there was a few extra books written on the stories of these people. Cause I just love to get in their headspace of like, what is it like to then go and follow Jesus after, like, there's seeming, like you said, I don't know, maybe we're not reading this culturally right. Is this, you know, pulling Peter down or raising Peter up? Exactly. Like, what is this? And my sense is it's raising people up because you're also pulling on different times in the Old Testament and God renamed people. And so still you just go like, you just love to have an insight. And what was it, what's it like to follow Jesus when you're also a little bit bitter that seemingly the person that you brought it, you know? So I don't know. There's just a lot of human elements here that I would love to be able to pick some people's brains on.
I totally echo that. Yeah, I do think, especially, you know, I have several brothers, and so sometimes when we sit around together, we'll just naturally gravitate. I don't know if this happens with you and your brothers, but naturally gravitate to stories, you know?
Sure.
And I can't imagine Peter not pulling out the, you know, one time I saw Elijah, and one time I saw Moses. And Andrew just thinking, why did I not to get to see Elijah Moses? Or Peter's like, I know we were all preaching, but did you notice it was when I preached at Pentecost that 3,000 people were converted? I kudos to Andrew. At the very least, kudos to Andrew for being there at the first. And number one, his brother gets named, and then John and his brother James form that inner circle. We say that so casually. It's like, well, you have the nine apostles, then you have the three apostles that were in the inner circle, and they're there at Gethsemane, and they're, you know, all these kind of things. And it's like, how is that not hurtful? And then when you hear James and John ask, apparently multiple times, hey, are we going to be the best of the best here? And Jesus not criticizing them directly. It's like, wow, I don't know. Like if we encouraged, and I don't know that he's encouraged, if we allowed that environment in churches, or when you allow that environment in churches, it's hard for people not to take on that competitive, unfair, well, that's unfair kind of dynamic so easily. And yet Jesus seems to, I don't know, move through it fluently, casually almost.
Mm, yeah, no, he does. And there's a sense in which you wonder, you see all the things, all the mistakes that Peter, here's another thought, like maybe Andrew's happy because we constantly get to see Peter, I'll PG PG-8 this story. PG-8 this phrase. You see Peter constantly showing his butt and how many mistakes he makes. You see him constantly and Jesus even directly, like, you know, trying to get. And so you go like, is Andrew kind of, oh, is he the quiet one who is like, you know, I'm okay letting Peter be out there in front? Because yeah. Peter might get Pentecost, but he also gets get behind me, Satan.
Right.
and maybe there's some, maybe there's some personality that, like, that, you know, there are certain things where you go, okay, I know I'm not the brother, but I'm actually glad that that's not the case. But yeah, you there's so much here. And again, like you said, it'd just be easy to just go, oh yeah, and his brother did this and yada 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 and moved on. But you go, no, there's, we all know with our family there are deep, deep thing. Every time we interact with our family, especially in adulthood, which is something that I didn't feel prepared for, that as you become more mature and you begin to look back at life, you go like, oh, every time I interact with these people that I deeply love, there's all these different strings that are pulling me, sometimes pulling me down, pulling me up. There's so many weird things happening that you go like, the fact that Jesus has these relationships in his core of disciples is so, it's so messy. It's so unbelievably messy, which I don't have a place. I don't have a, like you would think, never mind, I'm not going to go down that road. I just find myself completely, completely not concerned at all with how Jesus does it, but just slightly amused and baffled.
Mm-hmm. Baffled. That's a really good word. If it wasn't in the Bible and somebody's just saying, hey, I've got another tale about Jesus, I'm like, I don't think that happened. Yeah. Even something so simple. It's like, so you're saying he convinced his first apostles just by talking to him a little bit? And yeah. And next episode is more the same, different angle. But it's like, really, that's what, like, even Jesus seems a little surprised that Nathaniel's reaction. And so I just think,
We can leave that out. That's fine. You know, let's include some of the miracles that we had previously cut. We can leave this part out. If it's a words in the story, words in the essay, we can cut this part out.
Yeah, exactly. I just think that it is. I guess when it comes to application, it's like I'm a little bit at a loss for how would I apply this other than relax, be casual, love people around you, trust God. You know, which seems really cliche. But that's what happened.
Yeah, that's so good. And I think it's one of those things that's, it's really helpful to remind ourselves to rest in, that from the beginning, Jesus is not coming for you and I to experience only mountaintop moments, to only encounter mountaintop moments, that even in the boring middle where you don't even know there's a mountain coming up or there's a valley about to drop you really far below, that like there are parts, there are always things to discover of God, about God, with God, through God. And that is particularly compelling to me as somebody who finds myself in a very, not in a valley, not in a mountaintop moment, that God, we talk all the time about God being with you on the mountain and God being with you in the valley. But also God is not like, well, let me prep you. Let me only be prepping you for the mountain or the valley. But God's like, no, I'm right here alongside you in whatever the middle ground would be of that phrase. I'm not great with the geography of, I guess if there are only three ways we can talk about land, if the only two ways we can talk about land are valley or mountain, and then just normal, I don't know. There's probably a technical term, and maybe somebody will write and tell me, and I'll know. So next time I talk about this, I can sound a little bit smarter. That'd be awesome. Thank you for listening. Grace, peace, and love.